I'm talking today with Brian Howe, who is a practicing attorney in the Seattle area, and his company is Vox Legal, and he tweets at @socialbizlawyer. Brian, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Olivia. Glad to join you.
I was doing some research on you, and you have, I believe it's on your LinkedIn profile, that you provide innovative legal counsel for social business, which I think is a great way of framing what you do. Your focus is social enterprises, triple bottom line businesses, and some nonprofits with for-profit initiatives. I want to start out by asking, how does an entrepreneur who's forming a company determine what the best legal structure for her company is?
Sure, there's a variety of things that need to be considered at the early stage in choosing the best legal structure. I think there's a series of questions that any entrepreneur should ask themselves regarding, first and foremost, how important is profit to the enterprise? Is this something that they desire to get rich off of? Is this something that needs to be self-sustainable, meaning that the organization, the company, is going to be able to function without the need for outside donations or outside investments? Or is this something that profit is not primarily important to, and that what is more important is the mission of the organization and profit is secondary or not even on the radar? So once you decide the issues of profit, I think control is the next most important question. How important is it to you that you have control over your new social venture? Mm-hmm. Do you want to retain the ability to make decisions? Do you want to retain the ability to decide exactly how funds are used at any time? And how much of that are you willing to give up to outside donors or outside investors? And depending on how you decide those two questions, there's a variety of things that come off of that. Within legal structures as a whole, it's a very interesting time in that there's a few new forms and some hybrid opportunities that have really come to the surface in the last few years that haven't been in existence long enough to be fully established, but are certainly exciting for any new entrepreneur.
And that's the L3C you're referring to, or what are some of the other forms?
Sure. Well, the L3C is certainly one of them. The L3C is an organization based on the concept of limited liability companies, or the LLC. The LLC has been around for 20 plus years. The L3C is a new form of LLC that is designed primarily to attract program-related investments from foundations, and foundations give 5% to charitable causes, but that's not necessarily non-profit charitable causes. So there's actually an option to give to profitable charitable causes. And in the past, when a foundation desires to make a profit off of a program-related investment, they have to receive generally a private letter ruling from the IRS stating that the investment is going to constitute a charitable investment and it won't be taxed and won't affect the foundation's tax-free status. The L3C aims to mirror the language that the IRS has regarding program-related investment rulings in the actual foundation documents of the company, so that thereby they create a rebuttable presumption that any investment into an L3C is a program-related investment. The hope is that they're going to attract millions of dollars of foundation money into these new forms of L3Cs, as foundations will be able to receive a limited return on that money as opposed to no return. There's still some need for actual recognition by the IRS, Treasury, and there's a law that's being promulgated currently by Americans for Community Development. And we'll see federally whether or not they're successful at that. And if so, it certainly will be a game-changing event. The other main new legal structure is the B Corporation. Mm-hmm. And most people in this space in the U.S. are familiar with the B Corporation and the accompanying B Corp trademark. The B Corporation has been passed now in Maryland and Vermont, and there's legislation pending in a few states, including my state of Washington.
Ah. I mean, it's only at this point in Maryland and Vermont that a B Corporation status or certification would alter your legal status and your tax status, correct? And actually, let me just reframe that. I mean, I know that outside of those states, if you're a B Corporation, you write certain things and you agree to certain things in your company bylaws, but in terms of the legal and the tax laws. It's only for Vermont and Maryland currently.
Right, and that's exactly right. Okay. B Corps is more or less an international labeling scheme, and I don't say that as as a negative thing. It's a similar to fair trade, where you have to meet standards for price paid to the producer and be produced in a way that meets environmental, labor standards, etc. A B Corp sends a signal to other companies, to consumers, that your for-profit venture meets certain standards in dealing with different stakeholders. And the word stakeholder is different than the word shareholder. Shareholder connotes an individual that has ownership over a company and right to receive profits. Stakeholder is anyone who has some involvement or interest or is affected by the company. So stakeholder can include the environment, the community in which the business is operating, the employees of the business, the consumers or customers of the business, and a few others. So the B Corp, as you pointed out, the B Corporation is an actual legal form, whereas the B Corp is a labeling system. And so they work in conjunction. But only in Maryland and Vermont do you actually adopt the legal structure of a B Corporation. Hopefully that'll expand to other states for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. But there still is a possibility that regardless of which state you are incorporated or running your business in, you can adopt the label of a B Corp by going through their audit, which is available on the website.
I want to go back into the first decision and criteria that you laid out in determining what type of structure a business would want to take on is how important is profit. I know that there's a lot of nuances in this, and we should also put out the disclaimer that our conversation doesn't constitute legal advice. But if I have a company and profit is secondary to the mission, then what does that mean for me? What are some of these structures that I would want to consider first?
So if profit is secondary to the mission, you know, for years the default was, well, if what you care about is mission, then you need a nonprofit. That's certainly no longer the case. If profit is secondary to the mission, there's a variety of options that open up to you. And obviously, you have the option of a nonprofit. But it also comes down to if you're going to be financing your company in a traditional way, how are you going to be doing that? Are you going to be doing it through convertible debt, through investor debt, through founder's debt, through secured debt, unsecured debt, bank loans, etc.? Depending on which way you choose to finance it, it's going to affect a large portion of the sort of mission you're able to take on and the sort of control you have over that mission.
A nonprofit would be one possibility. What are some other ways that a company could look at structuring itself, or an organization could look at structuring itself if it wanted to preserve its mission?
Sure. Well, we have, you know, the variety of structures. There's obviously the traditional corporate forms of the C Corp and an S Corp, and now the emerging corporate form of the B Corp. Mm-hmm. And there's the limited liability company. Limited liability company offers incredible flexibility. So it's owned by the members. It's controlled typically by an operating agreement. And the investors, other non-founders, can be given very specific rules in the company, and that includes equity ownership, something that's being done more and more in recent years. So the LLC has a huge amount of flexibility and is attractive for a lot of those reasons. There's obviously partnership models, which I don't think is worth getting into right now, and sole proprietorship, co-ops, business leagues, operating foundations, political organizations, public charities, social clubs, civic leagues, independent foundations, corporate foundations, and fiscal sponsorship models. I'm sure that's not extremely helpful to just rattle off a list of different organizational forms, so maybe there's some follow-up we can do there.
You know, I think that I was leading you into kind of a tough question to make those judgments without knowing any details about my hypothetical company. But then let me go to the L3C model. And given that this model exists to help companies access PRIs, how would a company decide if the L3C model is the right model for them?
Well, again, the L3C is a form of the limited liability company, and it possesses the characteristic typical of an LLC, which includes tax implications, flexible ownership interests, limited liability protections for owners, which by far is the most important thing regarding the LLC, is when run properly and structured rightly, the LLC protects the actual owner's personal assets and limits any lawsuits brought against the company to the company's assets. So the distinct LLC and the L3C is that the primary purpose of the L3C is not for profit, but to achieve a socially beneficial objective, and profit therefore becomes the secondary goal. Mm-hmm. It's most useful for companies that are, again, looking at getting grants or investments from organizations. The federal law will make that incredibly more useful. At the moment, it simply sends a clear message that you are a mission-driven company. But it's a new form, and it, since it does place profit-making second, it has the potential of scaring off some investors. So those are the factors that need to be weighed when you're considering it. You need to look closely at your plan and realize exactly the sort of money that you need. If you have targeted foundations in mind for that money, are they comfortable with an L3C? Is this something that they've worked with in the past? And while it's, you know, in corporate form, it's largely untested in case law, IRS rulings, and it's unclear at the moment whether the purported benefits are going to hold up over time. But one of the ways to push the boundaries and find out, you know, are some of these new legal structures things that can truly turn into game-changing realities is to be willing to take those risks. And so companies that see the risk-reward balance and are willing to take the risk will certainly help push the conversation forward and can act to pave the way for the rest of the companies that might be more hesitant to engage in these new forms.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit about the type of model that allows for you to retain more control versus less control. In broader strokes, could you talk about that? Which ones facilitate greater ownership or control?
Obviously, it depends on your governance model and what sort of financing you have to raise. So if you're able to run a company, let me talk a little bit about the values that I think should be considered by someone when they are looking at an early stage foundation of a company.
Great.
You know, on one side, there's complexity. On the other side, there's simplicity. On one side, there's competency. On the other side, there's nimbleness. On one side, there's security. On the other side, there's risk. On one side, there's autonomy. On the other side, there's engagement. And when you're looking at all those and kind of deciding, where do I end up on this spectrum, that will really help drive the overall discussion. And when it comes to the exact issue of control, you need to decide how much control of profits am I willing to give up, how much control of governance decisions am I willing to give up. And in that discussion, it's also important to realize that by giving up control, you can truly bring on a level of leadership and advice that you wouldn't be able to have on by yourself. So it comes down to relationships, and that's what legal structure is at the end of the day. It is simply a codification of the relationships that we have, and that applies not just to business law, but really to society as a whole. Criminal law, we codify relationships that we have with one another. Business law, same thing. It's how are you going to work together in a way that's mutually beneficial to both? So while it's important to consider the exact specifications of am I willing to hand over ultimate authority to a board of directors? Am I willing to give up the majority of my profits to a venture capitalist investor? When it comes to those decisions, they can't be made in a vacuum. They have to be made looking at the exact relationships that are in place and the persons that are going to be taking over those controls. And I think that's one of the great things of this new push in social business is a lot of the old models of fear around this issue have become less and less. One really exciting
effort.
One exciting effort is the Presumed Abundance Fund, which is coming out of the city. And I'm not sure how familiar readers are with it.
Yeah, why don't you explain it? I'm familiar, and I've covered it a little bit, but please, go ahead.
Sure. The Presumed Abundance Fund, I think, does a great job at looking at this issue of control that typically leads to kind of a fear-based discussion on the part of the entrepreneur and the investor and turns it into a really interesting win-win scenario. And more or less, it came about because an investor was excited by what an entrepreneur was doing, wanted to give them some money and help them really grow their enterprise. And so as that discussion went on, your allies, up until the point that you begin to talk how much control the entrepreneur is willing to give up. And at the point that you get to that discussion, how much control are you willing to give up in exchange for this money, you become adversaries. Mm-hmm. And that's a hard turn for many individuals. Because it's kind of forced upon you, and you begin the process of negotiation. My type of attorneys are often brought in at that stage, accountants doing valuations of the companies, et cetera. And it can detract from the mission that you were both working to prior to that discussion. And so the Presumed Abundance Fund decided to go into a company, make an investment, and tell the entrepreneur that they decided how much equity to give up. And that's on the entrepreneur's shoulders. And however much equity they give up in exchange for this donation, when the Presumed Abundance Fund has made their money back, that entrepreneur turns around and reinvests the money they paid back to Presumed Abundance with Presumed Abundance. Together, they become investors in a new venture. So it turns that entrepreneur into an investor at the end of the first investment cycle. And it's a really fascinating way to do it. It obviously incentivizes the entrepreneur because they're excited to turn around and do for another what was just done for them. But it also takes away a lot of the pressure on the discussion of, you know, what sort of control am I willing to give up? Because whatever control you do give up, you also get to exercise control over that money that's paid back. So, in a sense, the investor is giving the entrepreneur total control in this model, although there's obviously some specifics about how it needs to be paid back, how it needs to be structured.
And that's interesting. And what's been, it's a relatively, Presumed Abundance is relatively new. Has there been validated success yet, or is it too soon to tell?
Yeah, well, I can't speak specifically to the success of each of their ventures, but I do know that they have achieved a level of success, and it's certainly gone well from my talks with them. There's some interesting discussions about what that model would look like in different formats. I've been discussing with them the possibility of doing an angel investment forum based on the Presumed Abundance model. The nice thing about it is it's obviously easily replicated, and the founders are very much open-handed with the way that they structured it, with their term sheets, which sets out the specifics of the agreement. So they really set, you know, here's a new way of doing it, and then opened up the possibility for others to take that model and build upon it and do different things with it. One of the ventures that Presumed Abundance is behind is ProFounder.com. And ProFounder.com was co-founded by two individuals. One of them is the previous founder of Kiva, the microfinance website. And ProFounder is a way to crowdsource investments for startup companies. It's a really interesting model. They have taken all the legal regulations around, you know, anytime you are raising money, obviously there's a variety of laws, federal and state, that come into play. And it's often been prohibitive to do friends and family financing, which is basically a company that needs, you know, a smaller amount of investment than venture capitalists would look at or even an angel investors would look at.
So
they
Brian,
go to
when you say prohibitive, what do you mean? Because I mean, I'm familiar with a lot of companies that have launched through friends and family investments.
Right. There's certainly some that have done it, and you know, not just some, many that have done it. But in the cost of doing so, they require attorneys like me to come in to analyze it and to make sure that they're complying with federal securities laws.
Okay.
So anytime you are asking an individual for money in exchange for some form of ownership over your company, you subject yourself to federal securities laws.
Okay.
There's a series of exemptions under which you don't have to register a security. The registration of a security is the most cost prohibitive factor in this entire discussion. There's a series of exemptions in which you don't have to register it, where you can raise from a limited pool of investors that meet a few different targets or a few different criteria. To get to that point and make sure you're complying with all those requirements, it requires, you know, lengthy discussions with attorneys, review of everything you're doing, and ProFounder has taken all of this and really created an online platform that automates the process. So it becomes something that is accessible to a much broader group of social entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs at large.
So this question is probably going to sound naive to you as an attorney, but if I'm an entrepreneur and I'm using ProFounder, do I need to also then elicit the support of an attorney like you, or can I do everything on ProFounder, or is it completely dependent on what my goals are?
Well, certainly I as an attorney, would recommend that you are working with someone in this. ProFounder has worked with some of the top attorneys in structuring this and are very proud of the model they've put together. And everything I've seen of it, it is impressive, and they've done good due diligence. However, that certainly shouldn't be construed as me recommending that entrepreneurs hire their attorneys and just work with ProFounder. You know, there's a variety of issues that can't be known except on an individual case-by-case basis. So I think the best model and the model that I hope to work with, I haven't had the chance to help finance any companies through ProFounder as of yet, but I have a few of my clients that are considering it. And the model that I'm going to be operating under is more or less a facilitator and a trusted advisor regarding the process. So it allows me to watch them through the process, oversee it, see if there's any red flags and yellow flags that come up, but doesn't require me to put in the time that it would take without those tools. And I like that because they are things that should be automated. And there are other ways that that my time should be spent, and so I have no problem with losing some money there, because I think it's such a great tool for my clients, for entrepreneurs.
Oh, great! Well, that's a great suggestion. I'm not familiar with ProFounder, so I'll definitely check that out. I want to talk quickly then about your business and your practice, because you're operating it, you know, with social entrepreneurial principles in mind as well. I mean, you run a virtual law firm, so you've got practically zero waste, and you're also applying for B Corp status yourself, and you do a couple of other things. For every 10 hours that you work, then you, the client, has the choice of donating the cost of an hour to a cause of their choice. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's a variety of causes that I work with on a pro bono or lowered rate fee. And so if I'm working with a client that's paying me at market rate, I love the idea that since I'm a service provider to them, and when I become a service provider, I become involved in their mission, that I invite them to become involved in my mission as well. And so they get to look at the organizations I'm working with and kind of donate together an hour of the law firm's time for every 10 hours work toward one of these organizations. Or if they prefer, they can recommend a new organization that we can vet together.
Another thing that I liked is that you were saying in the spirit of transparency, you allow clients to have real-time access to your time clock so that they can check up on your work and the billing at any file. And I just like that.
Yeah, and it's very advantageous to me. As a solo practitioner, I obviously have a variety of demands upon my time throughout the day. And I want my clients to know exactly what I'm doing. For too long, law firms have preferred to hide the ball and end up billing clients for things that are at best obscure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the average client can get very frustrated when they receive the invoice, and it can really become detrimental to the relationship between the client and the attorney. The Web 2.0 world software service model offers such an exciting variety of options to any entrepreneurs, including myself, and the ability to run a virtual time clock and have secure document storage where a client can access their own page within my firm at any time and see up to the minute this is what time I've put in on the project. That's what that equates to in terms of their bill, and then ask me questions if they have it at that point. It just makes sense from both sides. I'm not having to answer the phone to give constant updates because they can get on and see, but they also can get on and see at any time and don't have to worry about an attorney that's not returning their phone calls.
Do they feel that it helps you connect to their mission, given that you have some of these social awareness and sustainability practices in your own firm?
Yeah, it certainly seems to. You know, again, so much of this comes down to relationships. And as I'm admitted to practice in Washington State, and that's where my clients are based, is here in Washington. And so I get FaceTime with each of them. And, you know, everyone's aware, anyone in our space is aware of greenwashing or corporate social responsibility that is at best done for marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that takes place in law firms as well. And so while it's, you know, there's important to have these initiatives in a variety of law firms that have great environmental initiatives, great social initiatives, at the end of the day, a face-to-face meeting with an individual will give you a sense of whether or not this is truly part of their DNA or this is something that they're doing because they see a way to market or to take advantage, or to really try and, you know, sell themselves as a socially conscious, environmentally friendly service provider. And so while I think the words do attract some clients to me, it really is them getting to know me and connecting on a better level with our shared concerns and our shared passions.
Okay. Do you think that we'll see more attorneys who are specializing in triple bottom line social enterprise companies?
Yeah, there's actually a great movement right now of attorneys that are realizing they can build a sustainable practice based primarily on working with these sort of companies. And obviously that's because the market for these companies, the growth in this market, have been significant in the last few years, and so that raises the need for more service providers.
Mm-hmm.
It's been an exciting option to a lot of attorneys. There's some attorneys that have worked for decades with traditional entrepreneurs and have done a thing or two with double or triple bottom line companies and are now realizing they can shift their entire practice that way. One of the great things is that the pool is relatively small at this time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's easy to be in good conversation with the leading attorneys in the space. And currently New York, California, Colorado tend to have attorneys that are really thinking in these ways, thinking entrepreneurially and socially. And a lot of them are online as well, which
mm-hmm.
Is advantageous to facilitating the discussion. So there's a variety of platforms, whether Twitter or LinkedIn or blogging platforms, which we can come together and collaborate.
That's cool.
If I could suggest one resource that many of social entrepreneur attorneys are contributing to, It would be lawforchange.org. That's L-A-W-F-O-R, change.org. Law for Change is organized by Lex Mundi pro bono. Lex Mundi is an association of small law firms. And they've organized just a fantastic website of resources for social entrepreneurs to meet their legal needs. And the leading attorneys in this space are on there blogging, contributing thought, and it's extremely helpful.
Brian, I know that you're licensed to practice in Washington State, but that you also contract with other lawyers. If a company from Florida wants to work with you, are you able to provide them service?
It depends on the individual company's needs. Anyone is welcome to contact me. Simple contacting me doesn't establish a attorney-client relationship or an expectation of one. One of the things I pride myself on is having a relatively well-established network of excellent attorneys in this space, regardless of the location of the individual. So if I'm not able to assist the company or person in their need, I would love to be the one who's able to refer them to someone that can.
Well, great. Thanks so much for your time today, Brian, and for leading us through some of these criteria. And
absolutely. And I would give one final resource,
please,
if I can. Some of the comments I was making on structure come from Criterion Ventures Structure Lab material. Criterion Ventures is a organization based in New York City, ran by Dr. Joy Anderson, who was one of the founders of Good Capital. And she's developed a seminar on choosing the best legal structure for your social enterprise called Structure Lab. And it's a brilliant 6-hour game, more or less, where you consider the variety of relationships that you have in place. As I mentioned earlier, I view business law as simply a way to codify the relationships that you have in place. And Dr. Anderson seems to take the same approach. She's developed just some really impressive material and runs an excellent course across the nation. And anyone's able to log onto their website at criterionventures.com and go to the Structure Lab page and find out whether or not there's a course, a seminar that's coming up in your area. It's well worth the cost for any entrepreneur, any foundation, any investor or service provider that's involved in this area. Beyond the actual educational component, it's guaranteed to be a great networking opportunity.
That sounds really terrific.
Olivia, I enjoyed talking with you. Thanks for your time.
Oh, Brian, thank you.
For more interviews about Cause Capitalism, visit causecapitalism.com.